Dr. Stan here at the Radio of Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We're here in the central coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have on the line Jeffrey Smith, and he's written an amazing book called Seeds of Deception. Now, we hear a lot of talk about genetically modified food and how really it's so important that we have genetically modified food so we can feed the people throughout the world, and how wonderful the Green Revolution was. And the Green Revolution, I think, really was an amazing thing. But it was not genetically modified food. It was hybrid types of food, but they didn't change the genetic makeup of it. Well, I, for a long time, wondered whether we were talking about a tempest in a teapot or there really was a problem. But after listening to Jeffrey Smith, after talking to Jeffrey Smith, after reading his book, Seeds of Deception, I am firmly convinced that we are facing one of the greatest threats mankind has ever faced. And with that as the background, Jeffrey, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
You're most welcome, Dr. Stan.
Why don't you go ahead and just tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself and how it was that you came to write this book?
Well, I had been studying genetically engineered foods independently for about a decade. I ran for U.S. Congress to raise the public awareness of the health and environmental dangers. I worked at a GMO detection laboratory that detected genetically modified organisms in plants and food. And I was aware that there was a lot of very serious dangers associated with eating these foods and planting them in the wild that most Americans were not aware of. And I had read some books about it, and the books were kind of dry. They were informative, but they weren't all that captivating. And at the same time, I knew of some very captivating stories associated with genetically modified foods. For example, there was the scientist in the UK who discovered incriminating evidence showing that genetically modified foods could create serious damage to rats, and he was fired from his job and silenced with threats of a lawsuit. I knew of a University of California professor who claims he was threatened by a senior Mexican government official, claiming we know where your children go to school, trying to get them not to publish incriminating evidence. I knew of government scientists who were fired, threatened, stripped of responsibilities, or forced out when they expressed concerns over a genetically modified drug injected into cows to increase milk supply. And I knew of a deadly epidemic that killed about 100 Americans and caused 5,000 to 10,000 to fall sick, and yet the information that linked that epidemic to a genetically modified food supplement was largely hidden by the Food and Drug Administration in an apparent attempt to protect the biotech industry. So what I did is I took these stories of corruption, deceit, rigged research, and the ways in which industry has manipulated the government and the government has colluded to approve these dangerous foods, and I wound them into a series of stories called Seeds of Deception. And this is how I started the book.
Yeah, well, of course, the book is really a fascinating read. And, you know, it's not simply dry. You want to read it because it's interesting. And, you know, as you get in deeper and deeper, why you're going to get more and more information. Now, I think it's important that people understand that we've had certainly a means of improving crops. It's been used since the beginning of time. People who planted things knew how they could improve them and breed crops. But we're no longer breeding crops. We're changing the basic genetic makeup. And we're adding things to crops which God never intended to have there. And we're going to talk a lot more about that as we develop this idea of Jeffrey Smith and his book, Seeds of Deception. Well, Jeffrey, let's talk a little bit about why genetic engineering is different than breeding crops, because they tend to breed crops and of course, do all sorts of things to work and change crops. Certainly, Luther Burbank was famous for that sort of thing. So how is genetic engineering different than breeding of better crops?
Well, if you were to breed one brand of corn with another brand of corn, they're within the same species, and they exchange a whole, their entire genetic structure is mixed together properly. And if you were trying to breed a pig with a pig, it's the same thing. But with genetic engineering, you can take a single gene from a pig, for example, make some changes, and then put it into the DNA of corn. Now, these species would never naturally interact and mate in the environment, and yet we're artificially crossing these, taking genes and putting them in, crossing the species barrier and putting them into gene, into DNA that would never naturally have those genes. It's often a very violent technique. They'll take thousands of these individual genes and put them on little microscopic particles in a gene gun and blast it into thousands of cells on a plate, hoping that some of those genes make it into the DNA of some of those cells. Now, the process of creating a genetically modified crop has an enormous disruption to the DNA of the host plant. So it's not just taking a foreign DNA, piece of DNA or gene, and putting it into the DNA and having that as the problem, but typically there are hundreds or thousands of mutations that occur throughout the genome. You can change, well, there's one study that showed that 5% of the host genes change their levels of expression. You can turn genes off permanently, turn them on permanently, and change their levels of expression, cause genes to be inverted or mixed up with foreign material. And what it does is it messes up the functioning of the DNA in a myriad of potential ways. And yet, the biotechnology companies have tried to say this is a very precise and exact science with very predictable outcomes. In fact, there could be an increase of toxins, of allergens, of carcinogens, of anti-nutrients, of all sorts of things, and very, very few safety studies have been done. Certainly not enough to competently detect the whole host of unpredicted side effects.
I think that is really the real problem. In effect, why every American who eats genetically modified food, and literally every American is eating genetically modified food, is part of a gigantic experiment. Would that be a fair statement?
I would say so, although with experiments, you tend to monitor your results. Here, no one is looking. So, for example, even though between 1994 and 2001, corresponding the introduction of a lot of genetically modified...
Hold that thought right there, please. We're going to bring our other stations right back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Jeffrey Smith, and we're talking about his book, Seeds of Deception, and Jeffrey was explaining how they actually genetically modified food. He said that if you ordinarily breed one species of corn with another species of corn or another type of corn, you still get corn. You modify their genetic structure. But of course, when you're doing genetic engineering, you can take a gene all sorts of bacteria, and you can put them into a crop, or you can take a gene from an animal and you can put it into the corn, and you actually fire it in sort of helter-skelter with sort of a gene gun. They have the individual genes and they fire them onto individual cells, hope some of them take, and then you have an entirely different product, something that never existed throughout all history. And the problem that Jeffrey points out is that there are not really long-term studies, that we are sort of, everybody in America is part of a gigantic experiment, except, as he points out, in an experiment, why you monitor to see what the results are, whether they're good or bad or dangerous. And here in America, nobody's really looking to find out what the end result is, but certainly there can be toxins introduced, there can be new allergies will result. You pick up the story from there, Jeffrey.
Well, as I was mentioning, that between 1994 and 2001, there was a doubling of food-related illnesses in the United States. Now, we never checked to see if genetic modification was the cause. Similarly, in the UK, soy allergies skyrocketed by 50% soon after genetically modified soy was introduced there. Now, we know that genetically modified soy has a dramatic increase in a known allergen called trypsin inhibitor. There's also about a dozen ways in which a genetically modified food can have an increase in allergies. And yet there hasn't been a single human feeding study to see if these foods are more allergenic or not. And so we're kind of in an experiment, but it's an uncontrolled experiment. There's no control, there's no monitoring. At one point, the UK government had asked the executives of supermarkets for their purchasing data from those that had loyalty cards to see if those eating genetically modified food had higher levels of cancer, childhood allergies, or birth defects. But when this study became public, the embarrassed government, who had promised that there was no problem with these foods, quietly withdrew the study. So we're in a situation where people are eating the main genetically modified crops, which are soy, corn, cotton, and canola. Their DNA has been altered by artificial means, and there could be all sorts of potential problems. And yet people tend to not even know that they're genetically engineered, and we certainly don't know if there are some of the health dangers that we're seeing, for example, with the rats that are fed genetically modified food as part of these few experiments that have been done.
Well, now, of course, if there were problems feeding this to the rats, isn't it rather dangerous to feed it to human beings? Why don't you start out on the animal studies? The animal studies have been done, but very, very limited animal studies over a relatively short period of time. And there were problems that were totally ignored because, of course, Monsanto and the other genetic corporations who do this sort of thing wanted to get these products onto the market because we're talking about hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars of profit. So what about the animal studies? What have they really shown?
Well, there was a animal study funded by the UK government that showed that when rats were fed a genetically modified potato, experimental potato not on the market, the rats had potentially precancerous cell growth in their digestive tract, smaller brains, livers, and testicles, partial atrophy of the liver, and damaged immune system. In this case, the scientist went public with his concerns and was fired from his job after 35 years and silenced with threats of a lawsuit. There were rats that were fed genetically modified tomatoes, and they developed stomach lesions. 7 out of 40 died within 2 weeks, and over the objections of the FDA scientists, the tomato was approved.
Now, in other words, they had some sort of an FDA board or scientists who evaluated this, and they went ahead and approved it anyway?
Well, what happened was, typically, if you want to introduce a genetically modified food, you don't even have to tell the FDA, because the policy was created by someone who was formerly Monsanto's attorney and later Monsanto's vice president, and between those jobs, he had the position of being in charge of the policy for genetically modified foods at the Food and Drug Administration, and the White House had instructed the FDA to promote the biotechnology industry. So there's no real serious oversight, there's no mandatory studies whatsoever for the Food and Drug Administration. But only one company, Calgene, which was introducing the very first genetically modified crop, the Flavor Saver tomato, only they actually submitted detailed animal feeding data. And we were aware of the reactions by the scientists only because a lawsuit forced those secret memos into the public domain, and we read that the scientists saying that there was problems, there was stomach lesions, and that the studies did not indicate a reasonable certainty of no harm, and yet the supervisors, the political appointees, approved it. We also know from the secret memos that were made public that the overwhelming consensus among the scientists in the Food and Drug Administration were that these genetically modified foods could be very dangerous. They could create unpredicted allergies, toxins, new diseases, and nutritional problems, and they had actually urged their superiors to require long-term safety studies, but were ignored.
So what we really have is these products being released on the market. Now, most people don't even know there is genetically modified corn or canola,
right,
or cotton. And, you know, of course, the thing that I was really so interested in, I never thought of cotton. You know, you can't eat cotton. That's not going to affect me, so it's genetically modified. But why should we be concerned about genetically modified cotton?
Well, cotton, you've probably read cottonseed oil.
Right.
That comes from the seeds of cotton, and that's genetically engineered. 76% of the cotton in the United States is genetically engineered to withstand doses of herbicide or to create their own pesticide. And those are the two main traits, by the way. Those are 99.9% of all genetically modified crops are only genetically engineered either to create their own pesticide in every cell. And we by the way, eat those pesticides in the BT corn, for example, that's genetically engineered. Or they're engineered to withstand high doses of an herbicide, which would otherwise kill them. And so much higher levels of the herbicide are used, much higher residues end up on the plant, and we eat the herbicide.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the BT products, because these are corn that now generates a pesticide in every kernel of corn and every leaf of corn, and every stalk of corn is producing a pesticide that will kill the caterpillars. Isn't it that I can remember when I was young, why you'd see an ear of corn and you'd pull back and you'd find maybe a part of it, that the very base of the corn was a little eaten. There might even be a caterpillar there. So, but we don't see that anymore. These corn ears are just beautiful. But tell us, what's wrong? I mean, what is the possible harm with doing away with a caterpillar infest into the crop, the corn crop?
Well, there's a lot of problems with putting this pesticide into the corn. First of all, you have all the potential dangers just by the process of genetic engineering, which can cause all sorts of changes in the DNA and toxins. But the actual BT itself, when it was fed to mice, the mice showed an immune response equal to that of cholera toxin. They showed abnormal and excessive cell growth in their digestive tract. They showed an increased susceptibility to allergies. 39 Filipinos living next to a cornfield that was producing its own pesticide developed skin, respiratory, and intestinal reactions and fever while the corn was pollinating. Chickens died at twice the rate eating genetically modified corn compared to the non-GM corn. There's another corn that was recently approved by the European Union where a rat study showed that the rats developed reactions that are typical with allergic reactions or infections or anemia or high blood pressure or high blood sugar. Also, there was cows that were fed certain varieties of genetically modified corn and died mysteriously in Germany. 12 cows in a particular herd, and several got sick and had to be killed. Also, about 25 farmers in the United States report that when they fed certain varieties of genetically modified corn to their pigs, the pigs had trouble getting pregnant or had false pregnancies or even gave birth to bags of water. So we have all sorts of this anecdotal evidence and preliminary evidence and some very serious results, but we're not seeing the follow-up and we're not seeing the responses by those agencies that are supposedly designed to protect us.
Well, that really is quite concerning, and especially the story about the pig farms that were using this genetically modified corn. Now, was that the sort of corn that we would be eating? Was that this corn with the BT corn that you're speaking of?
Yes, there was actually different varieties of genetically modified corn, but all from the same parent line. And it was actually occurring not only in Iowa, which was my home state, but in as far east as New York and as north as Canada, all over North America. And there was efforts to try and study this corn, which were actually suppressed by the USDA and by the company that was going to be incriminated if this corn turned out to be problematic. And so it was a typical example, which I report on in detail, about how when incriminating evidence appears, there's a coordinated attempt by industry and by their representatives, both in government and academia, to protect the reputation of the industry. Now, remember, the industry, even though it's fairly big, it's actually very vulnerable. If a single health scare were to come out, it could destroy genetic engineering of food in one night. And that's hopefully what will happen. At least we won't have to wait for a health scare in terms of real damage if people simply become aware of the potential dangers out there and the preliminary evidence which shows serious harm.
Well, of course, we know that more and more men are having the difficulty reproducing. What part this plays, we really don't know. But we do know that the sperm count in men has fallen dramatically over that last few years. How long has the genetic engineering been around, Jeffrey?
The crop started being introduced in 1996 in a big way.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Jeffrey Smith. And this is a very real problem. You're not hearing about it through the mass media. Why? Well, they say the money talks. And believe me, if you start bringing out the truth on this subject, why, they're going to come after you as well. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Jeffrey Smith, his book, Seeds of Deception. Now, there was another study, my understanding, and that there was a study that was done on one of these genetically modified corn where they found that the rats had changes in their white cells and smaller kidneys. What was that study? What was that? That was a specific type of genetically modified corn, wasn't it?
Yes, Monsanto's, actually it was Monsanto's 863. And it was a very controversial study because the study was actually secret. All these submissions by the biotech companies, they claim confidential business information. And they're claiming that the reaction, the health reaction of rats to their corn is confidential because it might hurt competition. Of course, when people realize the dangers to the rats, of course it's going to hurt competition because no one's going to want to eat it. But it certainly shouldn't be secret. And that's what that was agreed to by the German courts, which ordered Monsanto to make it public.
How recently was this? This controversy came up in Europe.
The courts released it on June 20th, and I was in Germany at the time at a press conference with one of the leading scientists in the field who had been actually hired by the German government to secretly review it and give his review, and he described that it was certainly a toxic-type reaction in the rats, and it was certainly not possible that such a thing could have occurred by chance. But Monsanto was able to convince the pro-GM European regulators through some really unscientific manipulations that these dramatic changes in the rats, including lesions in their kidneys and livers and higher blood sugar levels and problems in the white blood cells and the red blood cells, they convinced them that these were just within the range of normal biological variability or some other bogus unscientific response and got away with it. And I happened to be interviewing both Dr. Pustai and another chief top endocrinologist in Europe who's on the two different committees that evaluate GMOs, and these guys were absolutely adamant that this food could be extremely dangerous to human beings and should never have been let on the market and required some follow-up studies because of the preliminary evidence. And yet it was just approved by the European regulators about 10 days ago.
Well, of course, the frightening thing is that, you know, here in the United States, these seems to go right on through the FDA? Are they the one to approve it?
Well, what happens is the FDA has no real requirements. If a company wants to, they can go through a voluntary consultation and show the FDA whatever they want. And if the FDA asks for further information, they're typically ignored. If something produces its own pesticide, like this BT corn, then because it's a pesticide, the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, looks at it, and they have very little requirements, very few requirements for health, and they let things basically on the market with a rubber stamp. In fact, that 90-day study that was found to have all these problems, even though it was a fairly short study, it's not even required to have a 90-day study by the EPA. They only look at 28-day studies. It's just ridiculous type of requirements. So they'll miss most of the potential problems that can be occurring with these foods.
And, of course, I think it's so vitally important that people understand that we really have no regulations here. Over in Europe, why the people have been very upset, have not wanted to have these products on the market, because over there, at least, I believe the media is much more honest about it, isn't it? Don't they discuss these issues?
Absolutely. That's actually the main reason why there's been rejection in Europe. You see, studies show that the more people...
Hold that thought. We're going right back to our network. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Jeffrey Smith, and we've been talking about a new type of corn. It's known as Monsanto 863. And they had done a 60 or 90 day rat study on this. Of course, it was a secret study. And they found that it created changes in the white cells, it created changes in the blood sugar level, it created changes in both the liver and kidney in the rats. And they put it on the market anyway after only 90 days. Over in Europe, of course, there was a great deal of concern about this, and there was a German judge that forced Monsanto to release their secret study, which they said, oh, we wouldn't want this information out because it's proprietary. Some of our competitors might find out about our rat study. Well, then eventually when the scientists over there saw what had happened, why, they were very, very concerned, and they did not want this released in Europe. course, it had already been released here in America, but they didn't want it released in Europe. But apparently, Monsanto must have had some friends among the regulators there. Would that be a fair statement?
I think it's a very fair statement. In fact, if your listeners would like to read about this, I wrote an article. It's posted on my website at seedsofdeception.com. I have a free monthly newsletter. It's a syndicated column. And the June newsletter is called Genetically Modified Corn Study Reveals Health Damage and Cover-Up. Now, we talked about the friends of Monsanto in high places. Let me give you an example. One of the people on the European Food Safety Authority, which is the big organization that will recommend any GMO to be approved by the European government, they have a lot of members of their committee that are actually part of other groups with a specific intention to promote the biotech industry. One supposed toxicologist, for example, voted to approve a corn after it had only been submitted to a 3-week test of 3 cows. Actually, there was 4 cows, but one of them died during the test. So it's completely unscientific, and what it is these scientists are told by the industry that they can't afford to introduce genetically modified food if they're required to do a lot of safety studies. And so they determine, they tell the scientists, we need to have a situation where we have the least possible safety studies in order to make this food viable. And the scientists go for it. They just have the assumption, the wishful thinking, that these foods are going to be safe. But the majority of the key assumptions that are used as the basis for safety claims have been overturned. In fact, one of the big problems that people were concerned about for years was that the genes that were inserted into genetically modified foods might transfer to the bacteria inside our gut. People were concerned that the antibiotic-resistant marker genes that were used in foods could turn bacteria inside us into super diseases that would be untreatable with antibiotics. Well, the biotech industry assured everyone that all these DNA and genes were destroyed during digestion. But the only human feeding study ever conducted on genetically engineered foods proved them wrong and showed that there is a greater risk than they thought, that the genes that are inserted into genetically modified crops actually do transfer to gut bacteria, which means even if you should decide to give up eating genetically modified soybeans, for example, that the genes that they inserted into those soybeans might live for a long time inside the DNA of your own gut bacteria producing this potentially dangerous protein. Now, we mentioned earlier that there's genes that produce pesticides. Imagine if that were to transfer to our gut bacteria. It could turn our intestinal flora into living pesticide factories.
And I think that what people don't understand is that these companies are playing God. They're modifying God's plan and genetic plan. And we know that cancer is increasing dramatically in America. We know that heart disease is increasing dramatically in America, and allergies and asthma and diabetes and so many complications out there, and nobody seems to want to ask why.
Absolutely. And we're in a situation where even in the government, when scientists raise concerns, they were censured or fired or stripped of responsibilities or forced out. Now, this was traced back even before the genetically modified crops came to the market. There was a genetically modified drug called recombinant bovine growth hormone, or RBGH, created by Monsanto and injected into cows to increase milk supply. And this has some really serious consequences, which we can talk about.
All right, fine. And, of course, that's the recombinant bovine growth hormone, and, of course, it really increases the output of milk. But what else does it do? What about the growth hormone that you're going to drink whenever you drink this milk? And everything has been done to prevent the American people from knowing about it. In fact, my understanding is that at least one of the milk producers wanted to put on their boxes or their containers, this contains no recombinant growth hormone. And, of course, they weren't allowed to. They
exactly.
Didn't want the American people to have the choice. We'll be back in just a minute. You can correct me if I didn't get the story quite right.
We'll be
right back in a moment. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening, Jeffrey Smith. We're talking about his book, Seeds of Deception. And really, it's a very important book, and I recommend it very, very strongly to you. Now, I was certainly telling a little bit about the recombinant bovine growth hormone. Tell us what all the implications are of this.
Well, what happens is when you inject a cow with RBGH, it increases something in the cow's milk called insulin-like growth factor 1, IGF-1. Now, milk has IGF-1 in it anyway. Milk drinkers increase their own levels of IGF-1. It's in humans as well, same exact same type of molecule. And they found that premenopausal women below the age of 50 with high levels of IGF-1 are 7 times more likely to develop breast cancer. That makes IGF-1 the highest risk factor for breast cancer next to family history in that age group. Men with high levels of IGF-1 are 4 times more likely to develop prostate cancer. It's also implicated in lung and colon cancer. And it is dramatically higher levels in milk from cows treated with RBGH. Now, this was going to be raised in a 4-part news series by a Fox TV affiliate in Florida. And 3 days before the 4-part news series was to air, a threatening letter was received by the Fox headquarters by Monsanto's attorney. And so the station pulled the show, and it was reviewed by the manager, and it was found to be completely accurate, raising all these issues about a potential cancer link. And they scheduled it again for the following week. And then another letter arrived. This time it was stronger, and it promised dire consequences to Fox TV and its owner, Rupert Murdoch. Well, what happened was these reporters, according to the reporters, were offered hush money to go away and never speak about the issue again, and they refused. And so they were the corporate attorney presided over rewrites over several months, 83 rewrites, making it softer and softer and softer and less incriminating for Monsanto's RBGH. And finally, the reporters refused to lie. They said, we're not going to say that it's the same milk as regular natural milk, even though Monsanto wanted that. And they were ultimately fired. And they sued Fox Television, and a jury awarded one of them $425,000. Well, Fox appealed, and Fox won the appeal on the basis that lying on television is not illegal. It's not against the law, which means...
Hold that thought right there, Jeffrey. Sure. We'll be right back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and I'm going to ask people if they will hold their calls until we do ask for them. I think this is such an important subject. And Jeffrey has been talking about something called the recombinant bovine growth hormone. And when you you inject a cow with this, why you get a marked increase in milk production? What is it, 30% or 40%?
Well, actually, they would like you to believe that. They said in the beginning it was 10 to 15, but some people are finding it's about 5 to 10. And it turns out that on the whole, on average, farmers don't actually increase their income by using it, because it also has a tremendously negative impact on the health of the cows. Some people describe how it lowers the life expectancy of a cow. It's caused cows theoretically to be crippled and to get serious infections. In fact, because it increases the infections in the cows, it increases the pus in the milk, and because too much pus is illegal, farmers typically use a lot of extra antibiotics. In order to get the allowable levels of antibiotics increased in the milk before this drug got approved, one of their own researchers took a position in the FDA, and then, according to a letter written by whistleblowers in the agency, randomly just increased the allowable antibiotics 100-fold to allow for the RBGH to be approved. So it's a very interesting way that when Monsanto wants certain policies done within the FDA, they'll put their own people into the positions to enact the policy.
And so who's going to watch the people who are watching the situation to protect the American people? And I think it's so important, as Jeffrey has brought out, what happens is that when you inject the cow, you produce large quantities of something called insulin-like growth factor. And, of course, it's already in milk, but it's markedly increased with the recombinant bovine growth hormone. And when you have that, it increases considerably. What was it, four times the increase of the incidence of prostate cancer?
It's a lot of different groups reported differently. One group found a 3.6-fold increase. Others showed an 80% increase. It is substantial. We don't know exactly what it is because there hasn't been a lot of follow-up research. But people are concerned also that right after the injections, there could be a skyrocketing. So if you happen to be drinking milk from a tank that it was just after injections, if you happen to be getting it from a local farm, it could be a very serious increase in IGF-1.
But of course, Jeff was saying that not only increases the incidence of prostate cancer, but breast cancer. And so there are real serious problems about this. But any effort to bring this out, even by some of the major networks, has been actually precipitated threats of lawsuits and from Monsanto, because the last thing they want is for the American people to know what's going on. My understanding was that there have been actually some companies, some dairies, that don't use the recombinant growth hormone, bovine growth hormone, and they wanted to actually label their milk, saying, we don't carry the recombinant bovine growth hormone, and they weren't allowed to say, we don't use this product?
That's right. Oakhurst Dairy in Maine had a label which said, Farmers Pledge No Artificial Hormones. And they were sued by Monsanto, who claimed that that label was giving their artificial hormones a bad name. And so after a few months of battles, the company decided to settle, and what they settled was to add to their carton that, according to the Food and Drug Administration, there's no difference between milk that's from cows that have been injected with RDGH compared to those that have not been injected. Now, according to the FDA's own studies, that's not true. It's a lie. According to the FDA's own studies, there's an increase in this IGF-1, an increase in antibiotics, an increase in pus, an increase in bovine growth hormone, all in the milk from cows injected. But the person who wrote that sentence was the former attorney to Monsanto, who became the policy chief of the FDA and later became Monsanto's vice president. So he wrote a completely unscientific sentence, which then was used as part of the settlement to include on the milk carton by Oakhurst Dairy.
And, of course, the thing is, everything is being done to conceal the information that's being put out tonight from the American people. And the reporters for Fox News, who actually put together a story, we're going to run it, were actually eventually fired, you know, because they wanted to tell the truth on television. And you're not, the American people are not to know what you're hearing today. Why? Because think of the implications if the American people realize that the milk we're drinking, that is much of it coming from cows that are receiving these hormone shots, these growth hormone shots, if you drink that milk, the incidence of breast and prostatic cancer increases considerably. That, how much, of course, nobody's going to put up the money for those studies, but we do know that prostatic cancer is just skyrocketing among men. Breast cancer is increasing dramatically among women. And the people in government say, shucks, we have no idea what's happening, but we're certainly not going to let you know that the milk that you're drinking wasn't produced with this recombinant growth hormone. So we've got real problems today. Jeffrey, are we making any progress? Are people in the United States beginning to understand that the health, their health and the health of their families are in jeopardy?
Well, I think we are, and I think that since studies show that the more people learn about GMOs, the less they trust them, we've got truth on our side. If we can get the information out, it'll have an impact. Now, I was just reading today, someone did a master's thesis on the impact of my book, Seeds of Deception, on the legislature of Vermont, because they were the first state legislature to vote on any regulations concerning genetically modified seeds. They have a seed labeling law now. And I was very gratified to hear that legislators said that it had a very significant impact. It affected the entire debate, and there was a series of interviews that this student had done for his thesis, and there was a group that had gotten the book inexpensively and was giving it away for anyone that made a donation. They were giving it to libraries and farmers and legislators, and that hundreds were given away, and that all of a sudden people were starting to rally and wanting to go to the state house to lobby because they had read my book. So So this is something that happened just in Vermont, but I have been to about 150 cities in 21 countries, and I'm happy to say that we are getting the information out, and in the United States, it's waking up. In California, there are some counties that have been that have ballot initiatives that have become GM-free. There's about 83 towns in Vermont that have voted resolutions to become GM-free. The wheat industry rejected flat out Monsanto's bid to introduce genetically modified wheat. But it's a tough battle, and we could use some help. So I encourage people to go to seedsofdeception.com and sign up for the free monthly newsletter and be informed about certain action alerts that can come up so that you can help out and pass on information to others.
And I certainly would second that. Jeffrey's information is excellent. It's based upon solid scientific evidence, which you're not going to read about in your local newspaper under most circumstances. Or if you do, it's going to be sort of altered to make it more, less concerning to the American people. Now, certainly the people of Europe, European population, has been very much against GMO foods, and yet, of course, tremendous pressure being brought to bear by our government to force them to accept these foods, which I believe are potentially dangerous. Are they succeeding? Is the American government working in concert with Monsanto and the other giant corporations succeeding in forcing the Europeans to accept this dangerous food?
Well, what's happening is the United States has used the World Trade Organization to threaten European Union with sanctions, and they've actually have a dispute, an official dispute, which hasn't been decided upon. And in reaction to that, the European government, the Union, has been trying to prove to the WTO that it's acting in good faith by approving more and more of the varieties of genetically modified crops. Now, even though the EU is approving them, because the consumers have said we're not going to eat them, it doesn't really have an effect on trade. Because they have a labeling scheme over there where people will know if something is made with genetically engineered foods, they won't want it. And so back in April of 1999, Unilever, Britain's largest food manufacturer, committed to take out all GM ingredients from its European brands. Within a week, almost every major food manufacturer followed suit, and it's been that way since. However, these same manufacturers, McDonald's, Burger King, Safeway, Nestle's, they make foods for the U.S. consumers that contain genetically modified ingredients because they say U.S. consumers don't care. Well, in reality, U.S. consumers don't know, and that's because of the closed media. The media either doesn't report on it or it reads like a biotech brochure. That's why I wrote my book, so I can get the information out that's not censored. That's why I created a video called Hidden Dangers in Kids' Meals, which describe how children are more at risk for the potential dangers. And that's why I have an audio CD that you can actually download for free and pass on to others from the website seedsofdeception.com. So I'm very anxious to get this information out, because as we saw in Europe, people voting with their dollars, expressing concern, changed the entire situation without having any requirements to have the government change the situation. It was a people-controlled revolution. It was consumers voting with their dollars saying, we don't want to eat this, and the manufacturer saying, we don't want to lose money, so we have to stop serving it. Now, it's interesting that what the Europeans are doing through their dollars, animals tend to do spontaneously. Eyewitness reports from all over North America describe how when animals are given the choice, they'll avoid eating genetically modified crops. These include cows and pigs and geese and chicken and mice and rats and elk and raccoons and deer, all showing a preference or a complete avoidance of genetically modified corn or soy when the two are made available, either in a pen or between separate fields.
Well, I think that it's something that the American people really must be made aware of. Now, what about the spread of this from field to field? In other words, they can put this into the seeds, and then those seeds, when they pollinate, or either the pollen or the seeds will blow into other seeds, other fields, and suddenly the whole food crop will become contaminated. How does that work?
Well, it's a very serious problem. You see, unlike a chemical spill, which will ultimately over time be cleaned up, genetic pollution can be self-replicating, and it could theoretically exist for as long as the species exists. And we've seen how genetically modified crops can cross-pollinate with their non-GM crops. They can even cross-pollinate with weedy relatives that are related to the crop, not just through pollination, but also birds and insects can not only cross-pollinate but actually carry seeds. There's also human mix-up. By accidentally thinking that a certain seed is non-genetically modified, research institutions and universities and seed dealers have given or sold them these seeds accidentally into the market. There's also been combinations and mix-ups inside harvesting equipment and storage equipment. So it's once these things are out, there's no way that we have been able to find them. There is no competent way to contain them. And so the source of corn, for example, in Mexico, with all the indigenous varieties of corn, they've been contaminated with genetically modified corn in spite of a ban of planting of genetically modified corn since 1998. There's the non-genetically modified canola has been completely contaminated with the GM varieties in Canada to the extent that the organic and non-GM canola farmers are suing Monsanto and Bayer Corporation for ruining their markets. So this is a very serious thing because it shows that we're making decisions now that might affect all future generations.
The very existence of humankind. Now, what about the concept of terminator seeds? In other words, putting something in the seed so that they will not, of course, germinate a second time around. So there's only one crop, and then you have to get new seeds from Monsanto?
Right. The U.S. government and also Delta Land and Pine, they developed a system where the seeds that are genetically engineered would be sterile after one season. Now, the reason they did this was because they wanted to market these seeds to the farmers of the developing countries. There's 1.2 billion farmers in the world that save seeds from their own harvest. And so they don't go to seed companies to buy seeds, and so the biotech industry wanted to open up this market to force these farmers to buy seeds from them. Now, what happens if this is not yet commercialized, but they're trying to push it onto the market, and if it does, imagine if those terminator seeds were to cross-pollinate with a neighbor's farm's crop. Now he saves his seed. Now, let's say he saves the seed and plants it and 20% don't germinate because they're terminator. So now he's forced to go to the seed companies to start buying again because he's lost the ability to save his seed. Now, right now, because terminator technology is not in place, Monsanto has farmers sign contracts saying that if they buy a genetically modified seed from Monsanto, they will have to, first of all, only use Monsanto's herbicide with it, and that they're not allowed to save their seeds. And not only that, but they're allowed to admit for Monsanto's crop cops to come on their property for the next 3 years to inspect to make sure that they haven't saved any seeds, and even look at their financial records and taxes. Now, what happens is, because of the cross-pollination, some farmers end up with genetically modified seeds and crops on their land simply from pollination. So Monsanto sometimes goes and checks it and finds a small amount of contamination and will threaten the farmer with a huge lawsuit, and sometimes farmers just have to pay because they're scared of Monsanto. So they've actually collected over $15 million from farmers, having sued 147 farmers. Now, there's a famous story of Percy Schmeisser in Western Canada who fought back, and he was sued, and the court said it doesn't matter if the contamination occurred from wind or insects. It has absolutely no bearing. If Monsanto's seeds are on his property, then Monsanto gets to win the lawsuit.
It sounds like we have some of the finest judges that money could buy up there in Canada, doesn't it?
Well, of course,
this is just total corruption of the system. And we haven't, well, maybe we could briefly touch on the Roundup Ready brand of corn and other crops that now, of course, Roundup won't kill, so they can use lots of it. But you also introduce these genes not only into the corn and the other crops, you get now super weeds. And, of course, what about these Roundup Ready crops? Haven't they been found to be somewhat harmful to the other living creatures?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of problems with the Roundup Ready. Let me explain. Monsanto found a bacteria in a dump site wastewater area that was surviving large concentrations of their herbicide Roundup. And so they realized that there was a resistant gene in this bacteria, which they took out of that bacteria and put it into the soybeans and other crops. And so now these soybeans can be sprayed with their Roundup herbicide, and the soybeans don't die. But all of the plants around them die. And so there's a lot more residue of the herbicide on the food which we eat, and that could be quite toxic.
But what about this genetic change? Is there any studies that show that this is not harmful to humans?
Well, there's no studies of it on humans, really. There's studies on rats, for example, that showed problems with the liver cells, mice that ate these genetically modified soybeans, and they had really dramatic changes in their liver cells.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment or two to wrap up this program with Jeffrey Smith. Jeffrey, how can people get your video?
They can go to seedsofdeception.com, or they can call 888-717-7000. That's 888-717-7000.
Thank you very much. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, the last segment of our program with Jeffrey Smith. And Jeffrey has, of course, written a fascinating book, Seeds of Deception, and we'll tell you more about that in just a few minutes. But, Jeffrey, you know, as we look at this and we see these Roundup-ready crops, and then what about the monarch butterfly? I understand that sometimes the various insects that come in contact with these genetically modified foods, really, they don't fare too well. What's that all about? And I've heard sometimes even amphibians, certain amphibians will have difficulty with these genetically modified foods.
Well, the butterfly story is an interesting one. The corn that's genetically engineered to produce its own pesticide is theoretically designed to kill, like, the European corn borer, but it turns out that studies show that it also endangers other non-target species, including species which are very good for the environment, like butterflies. And this was brought out in Cornell University. Now, what happened was Monsanto rushed its own studies, funded its own studies, and then even though they're not conclusive, they're claiming that their own studies have proven this to be wrong. But in reality, there's still a very large possibility that the 75% reduction in the monarch butterfly population this past year may have been contributed to by the presence of this genetically modified corn. That's because they give birth on these milkweeds, which are typically on the edge of cornfields. And so there's a lot of this toxic pollen which can be brushed onto these stalks, which could possibly cause a high mortality rate among the monarchs. So this is just one of several types of insects which have been studied to show actual or potential higher mortality rates. As far as the amphibians, that's more from the Roundup, the overuse of this herbicide. There was a recent study that showed that frogs might be being killed in large numbers by the overuse of this Roundup herbicide, which Monsanto claims is completely safe. Well, not completely safe, but they claim that it's safer than other things, but it turns out they tend not to test the whole Roundup product, just one isolated ingredient, and leave about 80 different ingredients untested.
So, in other words, you run the test so that you get the desired result, but you're really not concerned whether you're going to be harming people.
You know, this rigged research idea is rampant through the whole history of genetically engineered crops and food. For example, when Monsanto wanted to try and prove that injections of RBGH into their cows didn't interfere with fertility, they allegedly added cows to the study that were pregnant prior to injection.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up this evening's program with Jeffrey Smith. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening has been Jeffrey Smith, and we've been talking about his book, Seeds of Deception. We could go on for another hour, but we're out of time. Jeffrey, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
You're both welcome.
Really appreciate you being with us and look forward to talking to you on some of our other programs.
Thank you.
And give that telephone number out of yours one more time if people would like to learn more about what you have to offer.
Sure. It's 888-717-7000. That's 888-717-7000. 7000 or at seedsofdeception.com.
God bless, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope that you've heeded what Jeffrey has said, and it's just simply the tip of the iceberg. He has a number of excellent articles at his website or at newswithviews.com, where I read his articles. And I think that everybody out there in the listening audience should look and see how cancer is increasing, how the rate of diabetes is increasing, how the rate of heart disease is increasing. And our government officials say, oh, we know these things are happening, but we have no idea why. Well, if you, for instance, were to read some of the writings of people like Jacques Cousteau, writing quoted in the November 1991 issue of UNESCO Courier, talking about how there are too many people in the world and we're going to have to eliminate 350,000 people a day. If you'd like to, of course, get that reprint, we'd be glad to send it to you. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you're interested in this subject, why, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, or go to our website at radioliberty.com, where we cover a great deal of information on this and so many other subjects. You see, there really is a population control agenda out there. If you go to my website and you go to pull down the population agenda monograph, you're welcome to copy it and distribute that. And you read the writings of many of the people in key positions who've talked about the necessity of eliminating large percentages of the population because there are too many people in the world. And some people would say nothing could be that bad. Why, our government would not allow that, and I will tell you there are lots of wonderful people in the government. And they've tried to get the information out, and they're blocked at every turn. And a lot of people working at the Environmental Protection Agency, the scientists, have tried to get the truth out about water fluoridation or about so many other things. People working at the FDA have risked their jobs and their reputations and the threats of reprisal and gotten the information out, as Dr. David Graham did recently with the Vioxx situation that has caused somewhere between 88,000 and 160,000 heart attacks and strokes with a product that the producer knew was going to produce those complications and put them on the market anyway, but billions of dollars are at stake. And when you understand what really is at stake here, you can understand why such things would happen. And why should you be surprised when a nation has turned its back on God? And when you understand we're involved in a spiritual battle being carried out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield, then what's taking place really begins to take on an entirely different perspective. We hope that you'll go to our website at radioliberty.com and pull down our newsletters that talk about the spiritual battle. Feel free to copy them. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. You can listen to our internet programs there 5 hours a day. And we're on the American Freedom Network, the Genesis Network, the Radio Liberty Network, the Republic Network. Get the information and help us to get it out across America. Because believe me, your life, the life of your family, the lives of your loved ones are really in jeopardy today. I would not put this program on if I hadn't studied this information and was firmly convinced that Jeffrey Smith is absolutely right. You need to get the facts, you need to check the facts, and then you need to help us get the truth out. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for a revival in America, because if this country doesn't turn back to God, do you think that God will ever again bless this nation? After all, this nation has had so much. And, of course, our leaders have repudiated God. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls unless I specifically ask for calls, because we have two special guests this hour. One is Susan Miller, the other is Andrea Houghton, and we're going to be talking about what's going on in the Holy Land. Now, we've seen the video pictures recently of the people being forced to leave their homes in Gaza, forced to leave their livelihoods. Many of these people have been there 30 years. They have their greenhouses. They have their farms. They've had productive lives there. They've certainly withstood the threat of terrorist attacks by the Palestinians. And, of course, they were quite willing to accept the risk because this was their home. And I would like to ask the people in the listening audience how they would feel if the doctors, if the soldiers came and knocked on their door and said that the President of the United States has determined that they would have to leave their homes where they'd lived for 30 years, where they'd been told to go, where they'd been told they'd be secure, that Israel would always stand behind you, or if, here in the United States, that our government would not never take your home. And suddenly they've decided to turn your area over to a people from a foreign nation who hated you. How would you feel about that? Well, no, Susan Miller, and let's start with Susan. Susan, how are you tonight?
I'm very well, Dr. Stan. It's very nice to be with you tonight.
And Andrea, how are you?
I'm doing most wonderful. It's very good to be with you tonight.
All right, fine. Well, who's going to start out telling us how you got interested in and what you've, of course, found out about what's going on in the Holy Land?
Well, maybe I'll begin this a little bit here. I own a bookstore in Boulder, Colorado, that is kind of unusual. We call it a Hebrew roots bookstore, and it's a place where Christians are beginning to discover the Hebraic roots of their Christian faith. And so, and we have a lot of Jewish customers in there. You know, most Jewish people would not go into a Christian bookstore, nor would Christians go into a Judaica store, but they both come into this store, particular store, because it's all about Israel. And it's a concept that's about 10 years old now, this store, and we are beginning to see bridges being built between the Christian community and the Jewish community. And so this has kind of been a natural offshoot, I guess, being interested in what's going on, obviously, in Israel. Both Andrea and I have made several trips over to Israel in the last 10 years and so forth. And so we have our heart, our feet might be here in America, but I think our hearts have already moved over there to the land of Israel.
All right, fine. Well, now, do you sell then predominantly books about Israel, or do you sell some Christian books and some straight Jewish books, or do you just sort of cover the whole field?
It's predominantly books about Israel and Jewish books as well. And it's the kind of books that you will not find in your typical Christian bookstore.
All right.
And it's taken quite a few years to put a collection together.
Well, tell us what your take on is what's happening over there, because I'm very, very concerned that they're creating tremendous hostility towards the government over there. And I really fear that, of course, we're putting pressure, the United States is putting pressure on Israel to pull back on every front and give up the land that they've conquered after they were attacked. And this is going to make them into an almost indefensible enclave there, a small enclave on the shore of the Mediterranean.
Well, maybe we can talk about this Gush Katif area for just a few minutes.
Hold that thought. We're going to have to go to our first break. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest, Susan Miller and Andrea Houghton, and so we're going to talk about the Gush Katif area. Go ahead, pick up the story there.
Okay. Well, Andrea, why don't you tell them a little bit about Gush Katif and where it's at and what these people do down there.
Sure.
Have done down there.
The Gush Katif area is basically the southwestern tip of the Gaza Strip. And that, in 1967, was basically opened up for Jewish people to get in there and turn these sand dunes that were considered by the Arab population cursed land, land you could do nothing with, was given to the Israelis, the settlers, and they basically in the last 30-something years turned these sand dunes into the most amazing hothouses, greenhouses, growing miracle tomatoes, $100 million worth a year. And they're exported mainly to Europe. They have been exported. And they built this thriving community there. About 9,000 settlers live there. And beautiful homes. And that they made a living there. They took the risk being surrounded by Palestinians who attacked them consistently. Yet they chose to live there because that was considered the land of Israel given to them. And they did extremely well there.
Yes.
Now, of course, there weren't a lot of the Palestinians, though, employed by the Israelis.
Exactly. About 3,000 Palestinians were employed in those hothouses. They were treated extremely well. They received about $5 an hour and made a beautiful living there. And we have many reports where the Palestinians who worked there said, you know, we loved our Israeli employers, and we don't want to be under Palestinian rule.
Now, of course, the thing is that the Palestinian rule really is controlled by the radical Hamas and similar groups over there who do not want peace under any circumstances. And what puzzles me is why the Israeli leaders would think that showing signs of weakness and giving and giving and giving is ever going to buy peace. I mean, they've given up so much of Israel, and it hasn't brought any effort on the part of the other side for peace. They, radical Islamic people there in Hamas and Hezbollah and the other groups will not rest until the Jews have been either slaughtered or driven into the ocean. So why would they possibly give up Gaza?
Well, one thing that the Jewish people have been doing, Israel has been doing since 1948, is buying time.
Mm-hmm.
And they if they can delay it one more day, if they can delay a situation one more day, they have one more day, you know. And there's 22 Arab countries.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment.
All right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Susan Miller and Andrea Houghton, and we're talking about what's really going on in Israel today. And then the withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, and of course the Jews have been forced out now and have been forced back to Israel. Have they been compensated for their homes and for their greenhouses and their businesses?
Well, that was certainly the plan, and with the resistance and so forth, that has been in question as to whether they would willingly leave or the longer they would wait, the less the compensation was supposed to be. But that's all probably a lot of propaganda, I would imagine. I would imagine that these people are going to be compensated.
Yes.
And we were talking just a minute ago that, you know, there are 22 Arab countries, and we are about to see, we're right on the verge of watching the 23rd Arab country be born, the state of Palestine, and it's going to become this, like you said, Dr. Stan, a gathering place for these terrorist groups. And just some of the groups that are involved down there: the Palestinian Authority, represented by the Fatah Party, the PLO, the Hamas, which is Syrian-backed and ultimately Iranian-backed, financed by the Iranians, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Popular Struggle Front, the Islamic Jihad, Al-Qaeda, and they're all moving, it's like they're moving their headquarters down here to the Gaza now that the Jewish people are pulling out and will not be there to be this buffer zone for Israel anymore between Gaza and Egypt.
Well, of course, my understanding was that the homes were left. They certainly, many of the Israelis wanted to pick up the hothouses and move them back into Israel so they could continue their growing things. But they weren't allowed to. These, apparently, some rich Americans had paid for the hothouses so they could be turned over to the Palestinians. Or I don't know who in Palestine's going to get them. But obviously, we seem intent upon leaving everything there for the Palestinians.
That's correct, because the plan is that, yes, there was a deal made that 75% of the hot houses were purchased by, like you said, American donors for $14 million. The rest was supposed to be, was too late, basically, for the deal. And so the plan is for, that's what the Palestinians are planning, to basically continue the operation. Now, the only problem with that is the issue of exporting it. Israel had obviously airports, seaports, all these things that the Palestinians do not have at this point. So you may grow as much as you want. If you can't get it to your buyers, it doesn't do you much good. So that's where the issue lies. And then, of course, the managerial issue, will they be able to continue then?
Well, and the God issue also, because that land does not tend to produce for other people other than the Jewish people.
It's going to be very interesting to see what actually happens there.
Yes.
But my major concern is that there will become a headquarters for the terrorist movement, and of course pushing the Israelis further and further back into the enclave.
Yes.
Well, the only good thing about that, Dr. Stan, is that the Palestinians, there is so much infighting within their groups.
Yes.
Don't think for one minute that there is any cooperation amongst their groups. They are all scrambling as to who's going to be top dog over there in that pile, even as they're all coming into the area.
Sure.
Each leaders are bringing in like their own armies, their own uniforms, their own weapons.
And as we're speaking, Hamas and Islamic Jihad are just ready, as soon as the last soldier leaves, to pounce into this area. And basically the race is on who's getting the greatest amount of the spoils and who gets the largest territory before the Palestinian Authority actually can get there.
Well, you know, I was reading an interesting full-page advertisement in the New York Times, and it was written by people, of course, who were against what's happening,
mm-hmm.
and it was a letter sent to the President of the United States saying the American foreign policy is to force, to cajole, to make the Israelis withdraw from Gaza. Why would our government, the American government, be so intent upon forcing the Jewish settlers out of Gaza? Doesn't really make sense. There are a lot of people who say, oh, well, the tremendous Zionist influence in the United States, and they really control the government. And I always say to them, well, if they really control the government of the United States, they're not doing a very good job. Because the American government is doing everything they can, first of all, to actually finance the Palestine Liberation Movement and finance Arafat when he was alive, and now Abbas, now that Arafat has gone to the great beyond. And they've been supplying weapons to the Hamas and the other terrorist groups on one side, and then now they're pressuring the Jews to withdraw. It seems like we're financing both sides there. And of course, I don't see how this is going to benefit the Jews at all. All I can say to the people who believe the Zionists control the American government is they're not doing a very good job right now.
No, and it's an interesting thing you were asking earlier. Why would Israel even do this? And why would the American Jews not fight this tooth and nail and lobby? And it's an interesting syndrome. They call it actually the Oslo Syndrome, psychologists do. That's the name they have given it. And it's this thing that the Jewish intelligentsia seems to somehow think that your oppressor, your enemy, the people who have tried to kill you for decades now, You need to appease them with giving land, and it's almost like a battered woman who constantly goes back to the man who batters her.
Like feeding a tiger meat, hoping he's going to become a vegetarian.
Exactly right. It's this syndrome, and it's among the intelligentsia that maybe it's this desperate longing for peace, and the rational thinking maybe leaves a little bit here, and the thought, this delusion that by giving them land, then there will truly be peace. Which, of course, is not the case.
I really believe that there is a spiritual delusion, a spiritual blindness that grips not only the leaders of the United States, but the leaders of Israel as well.
Yes.
There's quite a thing here, too, because the United States will pay for this peace with dollars. Mm-hmm. And the Israelis are expected to pay for this peace with land.
Yeah.
But the wild card in this whole thing is that the Palestinians will have to pay for peace with peace. And they cannot, will not be able to do that. And that's going to be the wild card in this whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
They want peace, and they will have peace if Israel gives them this land. Israel is expecting to have peace with this. Not really, but on paper they do. And this is not what is going to be, because Islam is not, like you said earlier, Islam is not going to be satisfied, nor happy, nor content, until there is no more Israel, and until all the Jews are going glub glub in the Mediterranean Sea. It will not stop once this process has started.
Well, now, of course, the Palestinians want to make Jerusalem the head of their Palestinian state.
Correct.
The Jews cannot, of course, make those concessions. So how could you possibly get the two of them to live together peacefully?
Well, you can't. I mean, how could you? You have one party who, in its constitution, has called for the destruction of Israel and will not rest until all of Israel belongs to them. And on the other side, you have the other partner is really of the sentiment that human life is precious. Each human life, and you don't just throw it away. You don't have children, you know, that you encourage to become suicide bombers. So how can you combine these two ideologies? At the end, it's the battle of ideologies, and it's, like you said, a spiritual battle.
Of course, the interesting things that are happening today. My understanding is that many of the Hasidic Jews over there are beginning to make preparations to once again begin doing sacrifices in the temple on Temple Mount. Have you heard stories of this?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, they have. The priesthood has been trained. Mm-hmm. They have been practicing out in the desert lands, and the implements are all made. You know, the altar, the menorah, the whatever. Those things are all made. I guess they have like a. All they need is a cornerstone, and they can begin the sacrifices.
Now, of course, you're talking about the cornerstone to begin to rebuild the temple.
Right.
But of course, you can't rebuild the temple there on the Holy Mount there with the Mosque of Omar there. The Muslims would certainly not allow that. Tremendous unrest there. No Jew is actually allowed up on the Temple Mount. In fact, I don't even know if it's safe for visitors. Can visitors get in there at the present time?
Only at certain hours of the day and very limited.
All right. And of course, the Mosque of Omar, they were actually the Arabs that actually, the Mosque of Omar, of course, is the Golden Dome Mosque. And then there's the Al-Aqsa Mosque there at the end of the Temple Square. And my understanding is that the Arabs have been undermining that, trying to find any artifacts there that might be Jewish so they could destroy them to destroy the Jewish claim to the ownership of the Temple Mount. And they, in so doing, they've undermined the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Have you heard that?
Yes, yes. And that actually, that's why we have a crack in the wall around it. Remember, there were reports there are cracks in the wall because it's basically disturbing the foundations of these buildings there.
They're building an entire huge mosque down under there themselves, underneath the Temple Mount.
And they're taking truckloads of artifacts out and dumping them.
Yes.
All over the place.
And some of these are actually priceless artifacts,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
And excavating underneath the Temple Mount. But I've heard they're even over there undermining the the Mosque of Omar, the Dome of the Rock. Is it possible that they may undermine the very foundation of one of the most holy places in all of Islam?
That's a good point. Could very well be. Yes.
And sometimes I think we live in a world gone mad, and then other times I'm convinced we are. So what do you see happening now as far as the situation? Well, we're going to have to take a break here. We'll be back in just a moment with Susan Miller and Andrea Houghton and get their view of really what's happening in the Holy Land. It's a wonderful, exciting place. We've been there a number of times ourselves, and I look forward one day to being there again in Jerusalem. We'll be back in just a moment. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to take your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest Susan Miller, Andrea Houghton. Let's see, Andrea, what's happening to the economy over there as far as the people are concerned? What's going to happen to these 8,000 or 9,000 Jews who are returning from Gaza?
Well, the economy is not doing very well. Mr. Netanyahu, who resigned just 2 weeks ago as finance minister, did actually a beautiful job to bring the banking system up to par and do some reforms there that truly helped the Israeli economy. But there are struggles because this whole disengagement cost the Israeli government $7 billion. So that money has to come from somewhere. So there have been reports that it will cost each Israeli taxpayer $70,000. So the 9,000 people right now, they are put up in hotels, in kind of trailers. But all that has to be funded. The hotels want to be paid. They need food. So it's a tremendous strain to the Israeli economy.
And the Israeli government really did not make an awful lot of preparation in advance. This is something when the reports are that this is probably not going to work because they should have done a 100-year plan, economic forecasting out into the future kind of a thing. If you were going to create a shopping center here, you have to have an environmental impact statement, study done. They did none of that, really, and there's really no place for these people to go. Nothing has been prepared for them. And the Jewish people, they live in community. They live in neighborhoods. They live in family groupings kind of a thing. And so this is going to psychologically be very difficult on them being just sent out to hotels kind of spread around the country. As I understand, it's going to last for about a month's period of time.
But then, of course, they have to get jobs. I mean, where are they going to get jobs? How are they going to be able to support their families? And, and of course, how are they ever going to be able to buy new homes? And where is the money coming from? I had read that Mr. Wolfensohn, former head of the World Bank, had given $500,000 towards the financing the pullout, and my impression was that this money had to be coming from very wealthy people who had some sort of a specific agenda. In other words, they were intent upon forcing the Jews out, and they put up something $14 or $15 billion to buy the greenhouses.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that it would be very interesting to know who is really putting up the money and who is putting the pressure on the Bush administration.
Yes, yes. And another question that doesn't seem to be answered is, why the rush? It seems they're not, like Susan just said, I mean, if you plan to do this major operation, it should have been planned well 2 years ago when it was announced first. Why the wild scramble just a few weeks before it actually went into action and come up with trailer homes for the people and things like that? So why the rush and the lack of preparation?
Well, Andrea, I was hoping you and Susan would tell me the answer, because I personally believe this foretells something very big about to happen in this area. Now, I'm not certain what it is, but I don't think this is happening by accident.
No.
I think it's part of a long-range plan. I was sort of hoping you might have some thoughts as to what's happening, because I have the feeling we're sitting on the edge of a precipice, or standing on the edge of a precipice.
Yeah.
I just don't know what's down below there.
Yeah.
One of the things that's down below there is that Iran is getting closer and closer to developing the atomic weapons that they probably intend on using. We have got to understand...
Hold that right there, Susan. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we have with us Susan Miller and Andrea Houghton, and we will take calls if you'd like to call in. I think this is such an important subject. And the question was raised, why is Israel in such a hurry to do what they're doing? Why are they doing it at this time? And they're pulling all these families in. They have no places for them. They're staying in hotels. The government's got to finance them. They've got to come up with the money to compensate them for leaving their homes. A group of very, very wealthy people, among them James Wolfensohn, who has been the head of the World Bank, put up $500 million, supposedly of his own money, towards the buying of the greenhouses so they could leave them behind for the Palestinians. Now, why would James Wolfensohn of the World Bank do that? Who are the people who are putting up all the money? Who is it who's putting the pressure on the Israeli government to withdraw at this time? and what is their real agenda? And, of course, I was hoping that Susan and Andrea might maybe give me the answer. If they know, they're not going to tell me.
Well, we were discussing that. I mean, we just last week we talked about various issues here. Is it corruption? Because they are, and you may have read that plans are that in these withdrawn areas, in these areas, casinos and resorts are planned to be built, of which, of course, they're talking about $1 million a day, of which Mr. Perez and various other ones in the Israeli government will get paid. So, and as you may have also heard, World Bank just rated Israel as the most corrupt Western nation. So could it be corruption that we're talking about here?
All right, well, we've got Nathan, a friend of ours, longtime friend of ours who's Jewish, calling from Contra Costa County. Hi, Nathan. How are you? Haven't heard from you for a long time.
Long time, no see. How you doing, folks?
Doing fine.
We're doing
yeah.
Well.
Good. Well, you know, I wouldn't trust the World Bank to be really objective on anything. You know, the World Bank is, and the IMF are the most corrupt institutions. Frankly, I think that if anything, this is whether one's for or against the settlements, that's another subject. Israel definitely has been targeted by the UN and the New World Order crowd as far as giving up its sovereignty. Barry Hamish has covered this. Other authors have covered this. You know, I don't agree with everything Barry Hamish has said, but he's right on target when he says that the ultimate aim is to make, to nullify the spiritual influence of Jerusalem and to rev up those spiritual forces that oppose Jerusalem. And people need to understand, I understand the human tragedy of the Palestinians. I don't want to minimize that, but people have to understand the great, great, great land ownings that the Arabic peoples as a whole have, from the border between Iraq and Persia all the way into northern Africa. And they have to contrast that with a country the size of, I think it's, if you would start at Santa Cruz, it probably would extend past San Jose. It's not a very big country. I don't have the dimensions of it, but it's not a very big country. This is a manufactured issue.
10,000 square miles.
10,000 square miles.
That includes the West Bank and Gaza.
100 miles square, folks. That means it's 100 miles. If you put it in a box, it'd be 100 miles across and 100 miles down. That's not anything.
Yeah, or more appropriately, 50 miles wide and 100 miles long, or 200 miles long, which
is it's a manufactured issue. But
okay. Did you have a question at all for our guests?
Yeah, well, do you folks believe that, what scenario do you folks see happening here? Do you folks see a Palestinian state leading to events in the world, let's say end times prophecy, or do you see this whole thing as falling apart, possibly? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you all.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. All right. That was Nathan. Nathan wants to know what you think is going to happen.
Okay.
Well, we've got the Muslim population, the Islamic population, which makes up 25% of the world population, is out for world domination. And they're very patient. They say, we will wait. It doesn't matter how long we have to wait, which is part of this delay tactic game that Israel plays. We will wait, but we will win and you will lose. And their intention, and we're beginning to see this, is the radical Islam movement, obviously surfacing more and more. And their intention is to have this entire world under Islamic domination. And they have two houses in the Islamic world. One is the house of war and one is the house of peace. If you are not Islamic, you are in the house of war, and they intend to defeat you.
All right, fine. Well, we have Herman on the line. Herman, do you have a question for our guest? We're going to have you hold over until we're through the break. But what was your question? Herman, do you have a question?
Yes, I have a question. David Bay, Cutting Edge, continually says that the eventual plan is to pull the settlers back behind the security fence, and in some future war, the Palestinians would be completely wiped out.
All right,
and he's
fine.
Basing that on Obadiah, so I don't know if they have any comments. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a moment. Thank you, Herman. And I think we live in very uncertain times, and I really fear for the future of Israel and the Palestinians, in fact, that whole area of the world. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening, of course, is Susan Miller and her friend Andrea. And our guest was calling in and suggesting that there is one writer named David Bay, who we know is on the Internet with Cutting Edge, and he feels that the plan is to actually pull all of the Jews back into an enclave, and that there is going to be a war over there, and as a direct result of this war, there's going to be tremendous slaughter all through that region. And many of the Palestinians, if not all of them, will be wiped out. Do you think this is a possibility?
I think the Bible tends to agree with that.
And, of course, this is really what David depends on. And David's a friend of ours. He goes to the book of Obadiah and talks about that sort of thing. And you were talking a little earlier, Susan, about the fact that it looks like Iran is doing everything they can to flaunt the United States. And the United States is doing everything they can to flaunt Iran, almost as if in some insane way, as if being drawn, without logic, into some sort of a confrontation with Iran. We don't have the troops to do it. The only thing we could do would be to resort to the use of nuclear weapons. And if we were to use nuclear weapons against Iran, could we ever have any sense of outrage if somebody were to use nuclear weapons against America?
You know what, Dr. Stan, it seems to me, and this might be too simplistic, but I have to put things in simple terms. But there is we have the New World Order gang, and we have this Islamic gang, and then we have God's people. Okay, let's just break it into those three groups.
All right, you go ahead.
And the Islamic, I think the Islamic situation is going to be the first thing that will go down, and then God's people will deal with the New World Order plan. But there is one God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he has a plan, and his plan is working out. And all of these parties, all of these pieces of this puzzle, are instruments in his hand, you know. And it's watching that work out right in front of us. And it's his plan that's working. And when you have a plan, you got to let the plan work, you know. And we don't have to know exactly how it's going to happen, or when it's going to happen, or where it's going to happen. But the Bible talks about that God has a controversy with Esau, with Jacob's brother Esau. And the last time we heard of Esau, he was coming back. He was going to kill his brother, and that was back in the latter chapters of Genesis. And we're seeing this being played out now, 4,500 years later.
Well,
4,000 years later.
I would not in any way disagree with you. I'll ask our producer to get Andrea back on the line. We'll be right back here. All right, well, this is Dr. Stan, and I'm going to ask my producer to get Andrea back. We seem to have lost her somehow, but at least we have Susan with us, and hopefully Andrea will be back once again. Of course, it's Susan's point that really we're seeing God's plan being enacted in the Holy Land. Many things are happening that just do not make any sense. We had a Herman call in, and Herman from Carmel had commented that there are some people who believe, and he was specifically citing a man named David Bay, who writes something called The Cutting Edge, and you can get that up on the Internet. And David believes that they are going to intentionally pull back all the settlements, both from Gaza and from the West Bank, and get everybody behind an enclave into the enclave. And then there is going to be a war, and the Palestinian people are going to be wiped out. And this is a terrible thing to think of. But then, of course, we live in terrible, terrible times. And the Palestinian people are trapped in an impossible situation. If they don't want to be involved in the violence, they're going to be killed or attacked or destroyed by their own people. So the situation is that there seems to be a very little leeway on the parts of the leaders of the Palestinian movement. No dissent is allowed, and anybody who wants to live in peace with the Israelis certainly will many times be hauled out of their home and either stoned to death or beaten to death or simply executed. So and then, of course, we see what's happening with Iran, and it would appear totally illogical that the United States would even dare consider an attack on Iran. We don't have the troops to do it. The only way we could really attack Iran and take out their nuclear facilities would be by a preemptive nuclear strike on Iran. And think of the implications of America using nuclear weapons again, on a country that has not attacked us. So what are your thoughts on, and of course Susan's remark was, well, she feels that God has a plan, and that plan is being enacted. And I'm going to ask our producer if he wouldn't mind getting Andrea back on the line again, because we've lost her. Anyway, do you think that we may be looking upon the possibility of a nuclear strike on Iran? Is that even conceivable? Would our leaders be that mad?
Well, it would. Let's put it this way. This is a struggle between good and evil, between the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Satan. Okay? And when the Islamic people say Allah Akbar, which is their call, they're saying that Allah is greater. That's what Allah Akbar means. Allah is greater, meaning the God that is greater than the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Okay, that's what they're stating. So over in Mecca is this stone where the Islamic people go and make the Hajj and go around and round at Ramadan and so forth and make a trek to Mecca. If that were to be destroyed, that would have the effect on the Islamic people. Oh my gosh, Allah is not Akbar. He's not greater. And because this is a race between that God and destroying the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Okay, so that's the situation it is on the spirit realm. So there's some talk that if that stone were to be taken out in Mecca, that the Islamic people, it will destroy Islam. And that's the part that's going to destroy Islam. And that's when the Christians are going to have to go and get the Islamic people, the rest, those that don't come after us to kill us or whatever, but because it'll have that kind of a reaction too. But that will be picking up the pieces of Islam that will probably lead to one of the greatest revivals that this earth has ever seen.
Well, of course, you're absolutely right, Susan, when you say this is a spiritual battle. And God does have a plan. I don't know how it's going to work out. I think we can read the Bible. We can see, of course, Ezekiel 38 and 39, and we can almost tell who is going to be involved in this next great war. But everything to me suggests that that great war is upon us. And the average American here has no concept of what lies ahead. He thinks that nothing's going to change. Everything's going to be exactly as it was before, because of course he's ignored the fact that God always plays a part in folding of history. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, absolutely. It's his history. It's his story. You know, he's written it all out, and we've all read the end of the book, and we know that we win, or he wins. In the end, there is only God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Well, let's see. Is that Andrea? Are you back, Andrea? Well, it sounds like we've got Andrea. Let's see if we can get Andrea back again. It sounds more like a fax the whole line. Andrea, are you there? Well,
do you have her number?
Well, I think our producer does, and he'll call again.
Okay.
We keep getting her, and of course we get the fax line. Well, anyway, hopefully we'll have Andrea back again. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment about this issue, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And we'd like to know what you think, but I will tell you I'm very, very concerned. I believe America's that we have troops stationed there. We intend to keep our troops permanently stationed in the Middle East. We do not want to stop the unrest in Iraq, because if we were to establish a stable government there, how could we possibly justify keeping our troops there? And the major thrust of American foreign policy is permanently stationed troops in the Middle East, and one only has to read the writings of Zbigniew Brzezinski and the Project for the New American Century, and certainly William Kristol and the others, to realize that that is the real plan. But they can't tell the American people that. They would feel that we, of course, were led, and our leaders had lied to us. But leaders always lie. They have an entirely different agenda, and they don't really feel the American people are smart enough to understand what's taking place. And then behind their agenda, of course, I believe, is Satan's agenda, and then there's God's agenda, and these are indeed exciting times. Well, let's go to Herman, who's calling in. Hi, Herman. Do you have another question?
Yes,
Yes, in the Bible it says that those nations that bless Israel will be blessed, and those that curse Israel will be cursed. I don't know if this applies to modern-day Israel, but America is about to force the split up of Israel, force a Palestinian state upon that area, and I'm wondering if the guest believes there will be a retribution in any way for our actions as a nation. And the other, remember, the other thing it says is that every country that busies itself with Jerusalem, that Jerusalem will become a cup of trembling in the hands of the nations at the end of time.
All right.
So I'd just like a.
But you haven't come into that at all. Either Andrea, we got Andrea back, and
we're
we've
back.
Got Susan. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's obviously what Scripture says. So I feel for this country. I'm by birth a German, and Susan and I have been talking about that. But this is my home. And yes, that is my one reason why I have gotten so involved in this whole disengagement issue, because the caller is exactly right. I'm concerned for the United States, because there will be some possible retribution, and it may be in various forms.
All right, fine. Well, I certainly agree. Anything else, Sherman?
The other thing I heard recently is that the only place in the Bible where it asks us to pray for a place, a geographical place, is where we are instructed to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. So for all of those listeners who are Christians or Jews, I ask you to do that.
All right.
Dr. Stan, let me make a comment on that. That's out of Psalm 122, if I recall. And in Hebrew, the ancient Hebrew that Moses wrote the language down in, and David wrote down in and so forth, is like a picture language. And that word shalom is very interesting. When you put the words together, the little pictures together that say the word shalom, it literally says this: to destroy the authority that establishes chaos. That's what shalom literally means. We think it means peace or hello, goodbye. It literally means to destroy the authority that establishes chaos.
And of course, who establishes chaos but Satan?
Satan, exactly. So when that gives that meaning to pray for the peace of Jerusalem, a whole different aspect. We are to pray that the authority that establishes chaos would be destroyed for Jerusalem.
Okay, I think that that's a very, very important point. Anything else, Herman, before we let you go?
Final question. Do your callers believe it's important for Christians to visit Israel and Jerusalem? And I'll take the answer off.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
I would think so, because what it does, I think what we need to learn, especially in the Christian community, it's not us and them. We are one family. And the promises that are given to Israel, what we call Jews today, apply to us because we are grafted in. So Israel is our home. And so when we visit Israel, we visit our homeland. And yes, I do believe we should go there as often as we can. Not just to be enamored with it and not necessarily, Google Gaga at all the tourist sites, but realizing this is our home, this is where our forefathers walked. And it's going to be, whether we like it or not, whether we'll like it, will be the center point of this earth again.
All right. Any thoughts on that, Susan?
I totally, totally agree. And I think everybody's got an appointment in Jerusalem at some point in time in their life, now that in this generation, now that things have, Jerusalem has come back into the hands of the Jewish people. And when you go over there, you feel it. As soon as the plane lands down, there's something that happens in your spirit, and you realize that you are you're touching home somehow.
Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Andrea, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, fine. So our producer wanted to make sure we hadn't lost you again.
No, I don't know what went wrong here, but we sorted it out.
All right, fine. Well, I'm so glad we did. Well, my concern, of course, is for our troops in Iraq, for the Iraqi people, and of course, what I fear is the coming war with Iran or with somebody else over in that area. And if you look and see what's going on, nothing really makes any sense. I mean, where are the foreign insurgents coming from? Why, they're coming from our allies in Saudi Arabia. Who's funding the foreign insurgents from, predominantly from Saudi Arabia, but there's some from Pakistan, Iran, and Syria, and a few from Jordan. Why, the Saudi Arabians, and certainly the Syrians and the Iranians. So why aren't we getting the Saudi Arabians to do anything about it? Well, they keep promising to do something, and then they refuse to do it. And the new Saudi Arabian, ambassador to the United Nations is Prince Turki Al-Faisal, and he, for 24 years, was head of Saudi intelligence, working with Osama bin Laden, working with Al-Qaeda, and, of course, he has been part of that $1 trillion suit brought by Americans against Saudi Arabia for their involvement in 9/11. And, of course, the Bush administration refused to allow the suit to go forward. And this is the new Saudi ambassador to the United Nations being accepted now. And there's something wrong with the whole picture over there. It's like we're really not trying to solve the problem. We just want the problem so we can stay there. Do you ever have that feeling?
Yes, and there are no borders anymore, it seems like, especially in the Arab world. Those borders over there that they, you know, look on a map and Saudi Arabia looks like this. There's really no borders. I mean, these people just kind of move back and forth across the boundaries freely and get entangled in one another's politics, certainly, or their regimes. And that's beginning to happen here. I mean, they're doing away with our borders between Canada and the United States, between the United States and Mexico. It seems like, and Europe and so forth, it seems like someone is trying to erase borders here altogether, even as they're trying to erase the country of Israel right off the map. And one of the things that Condoleezza Rice did, the very first time she went to Israel right after she became Secretary of State, she went there and said, we cannot have a Palestinian state without contiguous borders. So she implemented a proposed land bridge that would join Gaza to the West Bank. And what that essentially does, I'm looking at the map right now, what that does is cut Israel in two. And international law says you cannot be a country unless you have contiguous borders. So that's just another evidence that the State Department or the New World Order boys, whatever, want to not have a Israel. There doesn't need to be an Israel in the greater Middle East in the days to come.
Well, I think the hardest thing for people to understand is that nothing is as it appears to be. And the American legislature and the American president does not make our foreign policy, and George Bush is not making our foreign policy. This is decided by people, as you refer to them, the New World Order boys, call them what you will, the Bilderbergers, the trilateralists, the Council on Foreign Relations. There is an elite who have determined a foreign policy. Their dedication is not to the survival of the United States, nor to the survival of Israel. Their dedication is to the idea of a one-world government and a new world religion, which will simply exclude both Christianity and Judaism. What are your thoughts on that,
Dr. Stan? That's where the crux of this whole thing comes, because the Bible says that God has not given us a spirit of fear,
that's right,
but of a love and of a sound mind. And a lot of times those kind of things just bring people into fear, and when people come into fear, they tend to kind of go into hibernation and put their head in the sand and deny anything that's going on, where we need to be exhorting people to get into their Bibles, to learn some of this stuff, what God says. God's plan is good. He created this. This is His creation. He looked at it, and He said, this is good. I like this. This is very good. Now, granted, man came along and we messed things up and we've fallen and we are in need of redemption, but even that plan is good, and His mercies are tender and they're new every morning, and He has a plan of redemption for us, and He's calling His people, His family, anyone who will listen at this point in time to run as fast as you can under His wings of protection. Because they're there, and His promises are true, and they're in the Bible. We just need to spend some time opening up His Word and saying, Father, speak to me. Thank You that You sent Your plan of redemption to this earth, and You paid the price for me. I'm Yours. We need to be claiming Him and pulling on Him, in the days ahead, because that's where our protection and our sanity is going to lie.
And it seems to be that there is right now this time of choosing. We have to choose. It's this time of separation that seems to be happening. Which side are you on? And as we walk from God, the further we walk away, this sound mind disappears, and these illogical things that we see happening around the world done by our government leaders could be the result of just that, that maybe wrong choices have been made.
Or perhaps they're being motivated by forces they don't even really understand.
Exactly.
And they are being drawn to make decisions which will be terribly detrimental for our country and for Israel and for the Arab people as well.
Why we need to pray for our leaders, too.
Amen to that. Well, we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program with Susan Miller and Andrea Houghton. Well, this is Dr. Stan and our guest, Susan Miller, Andrea Houghton. Do you have a website, or do you put out any publications that you'd like to tell our listeners about?
Well, I have a website for my bookstore down in Boulder, and it's the website is like Chai, High, it's High Life, but it's spelled C-H-A-I, and then Life, L-I-F-E.com, highlife.com.
All right, fine. And so if you'd like more information, and Susan and certainly Andrea are working, trying to educate people about what's going on. They have a Jewish bookstore, or predominantly books about the Holy Land and about what's going on over in Israel. And I really think it's so interesting that I hear that the rabbis certainly are working very hard and very rapidly preparing for the time, which they feel is really closer now than ever before, when they will resume their traditional Jewish practices. And I'm sure you've heard the same thing?
That's correct. That's exactly. Preparation is on, and everything seems to be in place.
Have you heard any rumors at all about the fact that they are trying to recover the Ark of the Covenant so it will be available?
Oh, those kind of rumors go on all the time.
Yes.
The guy was supposed to have brought that out on Monday.
And he didn't, huh?
He didn't. No.
No.
is this fellow a legitimate individual, or is he simply a figment of somebody's imagination?
The fellow is a legitimate fellow, and he's been over there in the land for many, many years, and he's actually the character that Indiana Jones was based off of, the archaeologist.
And basically, the story, my understanding, I've been told, but you correct me if I'm wrong, is that he says he knows where the Ark of the Covenant is, and he has been asked by the Jewish rabbis to bring it out and make it available to them. Is that right?
The story goes that it's a mysterious, unnamed Kabbalistic rabbi. So, you know, I'm not sure how reliable that is.
All right. Well, maybe it's just one of those rumors that makes the Internet so interesting.
Yes, yeah.
Well, we live in interesting times, and I think the important thing is that we have to keep our eyes firmly fixed on the Bible and the Scriptures, because that's the only source of real guide that we have. Would you agree?
Yes,
absolutely.
Very much.
Our comfort is there, and he's real, and he's absolutely there for his people. He wants to speak to them, and he speaks to them through his word. So
that's right. And talking about the events that have been happening in the last few days, and it looks, you know, so horrific and so frustrating and saddening, but we shall not forget that our Heavenly Father is in control, and no matter what devastating things are happening.
Well, God, we're out of time. Thank you both. God bless you both. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor.
Good night.
Good night, Doctor.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and certainly we have enjoyed our talk this evening. I think that we are living in very, very important and very dangerous times. And I think that we are seeing momentous changes coming as as Israel surrenders so much of the land. It's run in a series of wars, and it is doing what it's doing because of the American government. And, of course, the hierarchy which rules the world is putting pressure on Israel to withdraw into an enclave. And will this be the forerunner to the destruction of the Jewish people and driving them into the sea? Will it be the forerunner to a war that is coming with massive destruction of the Palestinian people? Well, we're just going to have to wait and see, but I really feel that everything looks very, very smooth and seems to be running well, and the stock market's doing well, and the economy's doing well. All of these things appear to be certainly progressing properly, but I have an uneasy feeling that nothing is as it appears to be. And as Paul Volcker said recently, we're skating on very, very thin ice. So keep your eyes fixed upon what's happening in the Holy Land. I think it will be a forerunner of things that are going to happen in this country. I fear that we are moving into World War III, and I think it's only a matter of time before this occurs. I don't know how it's going to be precipitated. Only time is going to tell. But understand, we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield. If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, we suggest that you read the information there. And please go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And you can certainly read our newsletters, pull them down, copy them, study them, and certainly the May and June newsletters. Deal with the occult hierarchy that rules the world, that comes from the dark side. And we simply quote what they say, not what I say, not what I believe, because that really is unimportant, but what the people on the other side say about what energizes them and where their power comes from. That's our May and June newsletters called The Occult Hierarchy Part 1, The Occult Hierarchy Part 2. And then, of course, we suggest you go to our website, and there you can, of course, listen to our radio programs on the Internet 3 hours a day. We have the archives. You can link to the other networks we're on. And, of course, listen to the Internet 5 hours every day. Not get a thing accomplished, but you'll get an awful lot of information. And then, of course, we hope that you'll tell other people about our Internet and shortwave and satellite and radio programs. Because what we do is trying to educate people and make them understand that nothing is as it appears to be. And there really are dark spiritual forces that dominate the unfolding of events. And behind that, of course, is God's plan for his people and for humankind. So we are involved in the spiritual battle, number one, and, of course, our obligation. We're not going to change what's going to happen, but our obligation is to reach as many people as we can in the time allotted to us with one simple question. Where are you going to spend eternity? Everybody's going to die. There's no question everybody's going to die, but where are you going to spend eternity? And if you were to stand before the gates of heaven and be asked, why should you be allowed to enter, what would your answer be? And you better know the right answer, because that time may be closer than you think. So please go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. If you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, we'd be glad to send it to you. And then we, of course, ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers, because we're told in the Holy Scriptures to do that. But lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. We are, of course, expanding our ministry out across America, syndicating our programs and on a new network, what as we heard throughout the Middle West, here starting in September. We could certainly use your help. So until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.